Hello, I'm Merrick Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is titled, America's Snack Habits Are Changing. Next, we'll do Scientists Clash Over Longevity by Amy Docker Marcus. First article was by David Marcus. Then we follow that up with Disabilities Act Become a License to Cheat by Jillian Letterman. And an article, To the Habitually Late, I Forgive You. Sort of, by Joe Queenan. We'll follow that up with an article by Emily Falk, How Small Talk Opens Up Deeper Connections. All of these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first article, America's Snack Habits Are Changing. Something strange is happening in the American diet. People just aren't reaching for cookies and pretzels the way they used to. It remains too soon to say whether this is just a temporary slowdown or the start of something bigger, perhaps related to the rise of weight loss drugs and healthier diets. But the cracks are showing. Take Pepsi Company's Frito-Lay, the dominant force in United States snacking known for Doritos and Lay's potato chips. Last year, for the first time since the financial crisis, the North American snack empire reported an annual sales decline, with revenue slipping to $24.76 billion in 2024 from $24.91 billion. And it isn't just Frito-Lay. The downturn is being felt across the industry. General Mills, Kraft Heinz, PepsiCo, and Campbell's have seen their stocks drop an average of 14% over the past year, even as the S&P has risen 8.5%. The snacking decline is coming at an awkward time for food companies, many of which have spent billions of dollars doubling down on indulgences. Last year, Mars struck a nearly $30 billion deal to acquire Kellanova, the maker of Pringles and Cheez-Its that was separated from Kellogg's cereal business. Back in 2023, J.M. Smucker paid $4.6 billion for Hostess brands, betting big on Twinkies and Ho-Hos. Those deals came at a time when it seemed as though Americans just couldn't stop snacking. The snacking business boomed in the years following the pandemic when people stuck at home during months of social isolation turned to Cheez-Its and Oreos for comfort. Even after restrictions eased, snack sales remained strong, bolstered by price hikes that consumers, flush with stimulus cash, absorbed without much resistance. Large food makers have blamed the slowdown on economic pressure weighing on American consumers who are increasingly trading down to private label options and opting for smaller package sizes. Asked if weight loss medications known as GLP-1 could have something to do with falling demand, General Mills chief executive Jeffrey Harmening pointed out that even dog treat sales are down, and he quipped during an earnings call, there are no GLP-1s for dogs. Yet a look under the hood of the $180 billion snacking industry also reveals a shift towards healthier options. Demand for high-protein snacks like Greek yogurt, meat sticks, and nutrition shakes surged last year, even as sales of sweet and salty snacks declined, notes Max Grumpert, packaged food analyst at BNP Paribas Exane. Fresh produce is also outperforming packaged goods, a trend which tends to accelerate when consumers feel the financial pinch. But as Bernstein analyst Alexa Howard points out, it could also be driven by underlying health and wellness trends across the broader United States population. In 2023, for the first time in more than a decade, the country's obesity rate declined from 44.1% to 43.96%, according to a study published in the JAMA Health Forum. The shift is small, but it could mark an inflection point. Some 5 to 10% of American drugs are already on GLP-1 like Wegovy and Mounjaro, whether for diabetes or obesity, and the trend is expected to accelerate as the drugs become more available. Snacks are high on the list of things takers don't want to eat, observes Marion Nefli, a professor emerita of food nutrition at New York University. Ultimately, the decline could reflect multiple trends at once. Lower income consumers could be cutting back primarily for financial reasons, while wealthier households may be gradually shifting their eating habits for health-related reasons. Another concern for food companies is that the so-called Make America Healthy Again, or MAHA movement, led by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a February TD Cowen survey revealed that 38% of respondents have grown more concerned about the health impacts of processed foods in recent months. If the rhetoric continues to gain traction, wrote TD Cowen analyst Robert Moskow, the value of the brand in the big food company portfolios will wither. As snacking habits evolve, so do food companies. The 1980s brought us Diet Coke. The 1990s saw the rise of fat-free products. The 2000s brought low-carb diets like Atkins, and the 2010s popularized plant-based foods such as the oatly milk. The 2020s appear to be the decade many Americans move to less processed foods and high-protein snacks, and companies are already moving in that direction too. Conagra brand, maker of Slim Jim, recently highlighted meat snacks as its fastest growing category. Earlier this year, PepsiCo completed a $1.2 billion acquisition of Siete Foods, known for its grain-free tortilla chips, and followed that with plans to acquire full ownership of its Sabra and Obela joint ventures, which produce dips and spreads like hummus. For food companies that are more heavily reliant on snacks packed with carbs and sugar, there are ample potential acquisition targets in the protein sector, notes BNP Gumport, pointing to companies like Chobani for yogurt or Barbells and Go Macro for protein bars as examples. Americans will never stop snacking, but when their snack preferences change, big food has to change with them. And now, scientists clash over longevity. Leonard Goretti was 38 and already a tenured professor at Massachusetts Institute of Technology when he decided to devote himself to one of the most alluring problems in biology, how to slow down aging. More than three decades later, the 72-year-old Goretti is considered a grandfather of the booming longevity movement. Top science journals have published his discovery about genes. He is an architect of one of the field's biggest ideas, has trained its most influential scientists, and helped create the company behind the suites of popular supplements. Now the field he shaped has moved from the fringes to science hot center. It's drawn billions in investment in recent years and is poised to draw even more attention under the Trump administration. Even so, the science behind longevity remains fiercely debated by those in the field, many of whom are building businesses based on still emerging research, and Goretti is at the forefront there too. Critics of his theories include former proteges and rival scientists. Many sell or promote their own supplements or champion other purported anti-aging treatments in the murky longevity market. ads for various products, sometimes tout clinical evidence, but studies are generally small, preliminary, and conducted over short periods. And there's no proof that taking them over the long term is safe. Consumers can't be sure where the science ends and the marketing begins. Guarente has argued that a family of genes called sirtuins control aging, and the molecules that help them do their job decline as people age. Maintaining youthful evidence of those molecules will keep sirtuins active longer and slow down aging. Guarente contends. Elsium Health, the company he co-founded in 2014, sells longevity supplements for $40 to $60 a bottle. Guarente said the seven Nobel laureates on Essium's board demonstrate the seriousness of his work. Studies by Essium, Guarente's MIT lab, and other respected scientists prove that sirtuins influence longevity, he said. When Matt Kaeberlein was a PhD student in Guarente's lab back in the 1990s, he demonstrated that a sirtuin gene in yeast extended longevity. He's since moved on. He co-authored a paper published in 2011 questioning whether these affected the lifespans of worms and flies. And despite hundreds of millions of dollars in National Institutes of Health and private funding spent over the past 2 days examining sirtuins, he said there is still no strong evidence they are important players in aging. I don't think anyone can say with a straight face, we have rock solid data, we have clinical trial data showing these things work for the people buying them, said Kaeberlein, who is now the CEO of Optispan, a healthcare technology company, and co-director of an NIH-funded trial testing whether the drug rapamycin, used to prevent organ rejection in transplant patients, extends lifespan in dogs. In the aging field, people have their favorite theory. It drives a lot of critique of theories that are not yours, Guarente said. It isn't uncommon for former proteges and rivals to question another scientist's signature discovery in cutting-edge science. But the stakes for longevity are growing as the movement gains prominence. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said he files an anti-aging protocol. Proposed Health and Human Services Deputy Jim O'Neill is the former chief executive at a nonprofit that funds longevity research. Some of the scientists driving the movement are pushing for changes in funding and regulations to speed up the development of anti-aging interventions. The longevity industry attracted $55.7 billion in global investment over the past decade, according to research and media company Longevity.Technology. Guarente said some of the sirtuin's detractors have ignored promising evidence because they back other interventions or don't believe scientists will succeed in slowing aging. It's a question of whether you look at the status of a field and you focus on it being half empty or the glass being half full, he said. Guarente grew up in the working class beach town of Revere, Massachusetts. He earned a bachelor's degree in biology at MIT, did his PhD and postdoc work at Harvard, and returned to MIT in 1981. He started studying how genes get turned on and off in cells. After he got tenure at age 34, he said, he wanted to switch his area of research to a subject where he might solve a major scientific problem. In 1990, two graduate students interviewing for jobs at his lab told him they wanted to search for genes that might point to clues about aging. Biologists often start studies in yeast, which are easy to grow in the lab. After the students showed promising results, Guarente was hooked. Eventually, his entire lab was studying aging. His lab found that without sirtuins, cells age more quickly. And sirtuins require a molecule called nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, or NAD, as to many crucial jobs, such as repairing DNA and making energy. Many, but not all scientists, believe NAD levels decline as we age. Orenti built Asylum on the idea that boosting NAD levels to youthful activities can keep sirtuins active, in turn slowing aging and extending life. From early on, Orenti pursued longevity as both science and business. In 1999, he co-founded Elixir Pharmaceuticals, which shut down before it could get an anti-aging drug to market. In 2007, he became co-chair of the Scientific Advisory Board of Sirtuins Pharmaceuticals, co-founded by his former protege, David Sinclair. Sinclair, who is now one of the most well-known and controversial names in the field, trained in Orenti's lab from 1995 to 1999, then he moved to Harvard. Sirtuins was developing a formulation of resveratrol, a compound found in red wine that showed promise in extending the lifespan of worms and mice on a high-calorie diet. Pharmaceutical giant GSK acquired Sirtuins in 2008 for $720 million. GSK stopped the study testing the drug in cancer patients in 2010 over safety concerns and said in 2013 it would close Sirtuins. Orenti continued to consult for GSK on Sirtuins for another year or two. Back in 2012, Orenti got a call from Eric Martinuzzi, a partner at Sequoia Capital, who as a Harvard Business School student had been assigned a case study about Sirtuins. Martinuzzi's professor asked the students to think about the options Sirtuins was considering, including selling a version of resveratrol directly to consumers as a supplement or cutting a deal with a pharmaceutical company. Martinuzzi, a former college wrestler who had taken fish oil, vitamin D, and other supplements over the years, said he was one of the few arguing Sirtuins should sell resveratrol as a supplement. He was interested in trying to find natural compounds that could slow aging. Both Martinuzzi and Orenti said they wanted to do rigorous tests to bolster consumer trust. After more conversations, Martinuzzi asked Orenti which of the compounds looked the most promising. "I would put my bets on NAD boosters," Orenti said. They co-founded Asylum in 2014 with another partner. Asylum's first product, called Basis, combined nicotinamide riboside, or NR, which is a form of vitamin B and a building block of NAD, and persotilbene, a compound found in blueberries. Asylum says both activate sirtuins. Today, Asylum has seven supplements. Orenti said he recruited prominent scientists to the board to lend gravitas to and help guide Asylum's work. "Lenny wanted to collect an amazing scientific advisory board," said George Church, a Harvard geneticist who was on the board until late last year. Church said he joined the board because he valued Orenti's commitment to running clinical trials. "Normally, I would not be involved with supplements because I think they have low efficacy," he said. Church, whose projects include trying to revive the woolly mammoth, co-founded his own anti-aging company in 2018 that is trying to develop a gene therapy that would require FDA approval. "I think aging is a much more complicated thing to fix. I'm doubling down on gene therapy," he said. Asylum's first clinical trial involved 120 healthy older people who received either a single or double dose, the Basis supplement, or a placebo. The company published a study in 2017 that showed both doses increased NAD levels over 8 weeks compared with the placebo group. Dr. Eric Verdine, CEO and president of the Buck Institute for Research on Aging in Novato, California, an independent research institution, has worked on sirtuins and NAD for more than 25 years. He's also funded or co-funded several longevity companies, including a new one that's developing therapeutic plasma exchange, which involves replacing patients' blood plasma as a possible anti-aging therapy. He said, church links remain promising targets that are worth studying. Still, he added that the more you study something, the more you understand the complexity. There is no magic pill, even though we would all love the idea that there's going to be something magical that solves all of your problems and prevents you from aging. One issue hanging over supplement companies, including Asylum, is a dispute over selling supplements that other companies are testing as drugs, something the FDA prohibits. Asylum supplements include one containing NMN, a building block of NAD. Metro International Biotech, company co-founded by Sinclair, Guaranty's former protege, is developing a version of NMN that is hopes might someday be approved by the FDA to treat age-related diseases such as Alzheimer's. The FDA said that in 2023, that under current regulations, NMN shouldn't be marketed as a supplement, a position Metro advocated. The Natural Products Association, a trade group representing retailers and supplement makers, including Asylum, sued the FDA last year to clarify its regulations and allow NMN to continue to be sold. A judge gave the FDA until this July to respond. Asylum currently sells its NMN supplement through its website, and a spokeswoman said Metro's position was entirely motivated by a perceived ability to make a larger profit. Metro said the company had been investigating NMN in FDA-authorized trials before any legal sales of NMN by supplemental companies. Sinclair, who is on the company's scientific advisory board but does not have a management role, said, I believe people should have access to supplements and medicines, but they should be tested for purity, safety, and efficacy. In a statement posted on X, he said the work of bringing NMN to market as an FDA-approved drug to treat age-related diseases is in the best interest of patients. Guaranty and Sinclair continue to work together, including on a company they co-founded in 2017, Galilei Biosciences, which is also involved in sirtuins. Guaranty continues to write and speak about connections among sirtuins, NAD levels, and longevity. SEM started a long-term study in 2023 that aimed to enroll 25,000 people and look for connections between lifestyle, health, and aging. Around 2,500 people have enrolled so far, and some have shared blood work results and medical history, according to SEM. Guaranty said that despite past challenges, studies are validating his views in aging. He pointed to a 2022 study reporting that a mutation in a sirtuin gene found in some centenarians might contribute to their longevity. He is not giving up on the idea of longevity science. It is a little more complicated than inventions that have led to progress, he said. The automobile is so tangible. It speaks for itself. This does not speak for itself. It needs a spokesperson. And now, on a different tack, Disabilities Act becomes a license to cheat. President Trump's pledge to eliminate the Education Department is welcome, but it won't be enough to fix American schools. Federal laws intended to accommodate students with learning disabilities have for years allowed parents and schools in the country's wealthiest enclaves to game the system by giving unfair advantages to the children of privilege. The Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990 requires schools to offer examinations in a place and manner accessible to persons with disabilities or offer alternative accessible arrangements for such individuals. The law defines disabilities as conditions that impair major life activities, a category that Congress broadened in 2008 to include tasks such as reading, concentrating, and thinking. Common learning disabilities include dyslexia and ADHD. Students with accommodations are often given more time than other students to take exams. They are also sometimes allowed to use reference sheets or sit out the classroom to avoid distraction, among other options. Truly disabled students need support to help them succeed, but the system is ripe for abuse by those with the knowledge and means to investigate it. A 2019 Wall Street Journal investigation revealed that many wealthy parents pay thousands of dollars for their children to be tested for learning disabilities by private psychologists who have an incentive to give clients a diagnosis that will confer an advantage. At public high schools in wealthy areas, the percentage of students with access to accommodations is 4.2%, compared with 2.8% nationally. The statistics obscure the worst examples. The journal found that the rate was 1 in 5 at Scarsdale High School in New York, 1 in 4 in Weston High School in Connecticut, and 1 in 3 at Newton North High School in Massachusetts. A 10th grader at a private high school in Massachusetts who requested anonymity estimates the percentage at her school is close to the half. In a math class with 9 students, she's the only one who does not receive extra time on tests. When the period is up, she's called by name to hand in her exam. The other students keep working. How is that even possible, she asked. I'm like, can I just have the extra time for this class? Because I don't need it, but if everyone else can have it, then I don't see why I can't. She says it's no secret that the system is easy to game. Everyone that I've talked to says that if you don't have extra time, then your parents don't love you because it's so easy to get. Federal law prohibits colleges from asking students about accommodations during admissions, and the College Board, which administers the SAT and other standardized tests, stopped flagging students' use of accommodations back in 2003. The New York Times found in 2019 that the rate of students receiving extra time on the SAT had doubled to 4% from 2% in 2002, with white and affluent students highly overrepresented. More time has a generally positive effect on performance, particularly for higher ability students. Karen Kolababa, a special education teacher at an elementary school in Colorado, says there are some wealthier, more affluent families that kind of get entitled and they feel like their kids should be getting accommodations. The point of accommodations is that they're supposed to help even the playing field so that everybody can show what they know. While some students truly need accommodations, many schools don't distinguish between necessary arrangements and gratuitous ones. SAR High School, a private Jewish school in New York, recently decided to increase the length of its testing blocks by 50% for all students. Caleb Eden, a 12th grader, said students frequently claim that students used to be able to complete tests in the standard 40 minutes. Now, he says, a vast majority of the class uses some extra chunk of the extra time. It's no surprise that students appreciate extra time, but there's no entitlement to loose deadlines in the world of work, and it's a disservice to teach students otherwise. The 2024 Literature Review in the Journal of Applied School Psychology found that extended time improves test scores but may increase student anxiety and overthinking. The solution is simple. Require students to disclose their use of testing accommodations during the college admissions process. Like grades and extracurricular activities, accommodations are relevant to college admissions. No one should fault a blind student for taking tests in Braille or a student with severe dyslexia who used audio aids. But the incentive structure must dissuade needless accommodations. Parents of students with mild testing anxiety, for example, might think twice before obtaining extra time if they know that admissions officers will ask for an explanation. It's time for some accommodation accountability. Federal law currently treats the mandated disclosure of accommodations as an act of discrimination against students with disabilities. Congress will have to change this so that parents who send their kids to America's most selective, expensive, and prestigious institutions can no longer game the system. And now let's do Joe Queenan to the habitually late, I forgive you, sort of. Two of my closest friends routinely say, I'll be there in 5 minutes, or just give me 5 minutes, or I should be there in 5 minutes. But this is never, ever true. 5 minutes is usually 15 minutes, and sometimes as long as a half hour. As a result, I end up getting forced to give up the diner booth because I am the only patron, or told to go sit at the bar nursing a $15 cranberry juice until my party arrives, or made to stand in subarctic temperatures outside a subway station in a really bad neighborhood, looking like a tourist who is just begging to be mugged, or having to idle in the car in a no parking ever, no seriously never zone in Midtown Manhattan. This stuff used to make me really mad, but all through my life, it kept happening over and over again. And then I'll end up missing the opening kickoff or the start of the concert or the irretrievable moment when the bride walks up the aisle because I was waiting around outside of the entrance, waiting for someone I knew who would be, oh, certainly be 25 minutes late. But lately, I've come to realize that the chronically tardy are not late because they can't keep time or because they don't care that they have kept you waiting or because they never leave enough time to catch the train or find a parking spot. They're late because they practice something called aspirational chronometry. The actual aspirational time rate are people who honestly think that time can miraculously expand to accommodate their needs. People who are always surprised to discover that the train has left, the cake is burned, the game is over, the blind date has up and left. People who are always late are like people who are always befuddled that their diets never work or that their new clothes never fit. Just like people who buy a size 8 dress or size 34 to 36 trousers in the vain hope they might eventually fit into them, the aspirationally chronometric honestly believe that by saying the words, I'll be there in 5 minutes, they will actually be there in 5 minutes. Arriving 40 minutes late always comes as a shock. I do not believe that the chronically tardy should be excoriated or ridiculed or cast out into the darkness. Just as some of us are insensitive and some of us are cheap and some of us are not so great around children, and some of us tell inappropriate jokes in refined social settings, some people couldn't arrive on time if their life depended on it. There is nothing to be done about it. The behavior cannot be cured. Making people feel guilty about their maddening tardiness is only going to make things worse. The best course of action is to grin and bear it, or start showing up late yourself and see how they like it, or deliberately send them to the wrong rendezvous point. One caveat, though, this non-aggression policy will work with friends, but it will not work with spouses or partners. You only see your friends from time to time, but you see your partner every day, which means your significant other is going to keep you waiting every day. How to deal with this? At this point, it might be, well, too late. But if you notice early in your relationship that your partner is always, always tardy, it's best to pull the plug on the love affair and move to someone who is more chronometrically reliable. Just as you would bring down the curtain on a relationship with someone who had a bad drug habit, who seemed way too fond of World War I era ordnance, you should immediately walk away from a prospective partner as soon as you realize that they're going to be a half hour behind for everything for the next 65 years. Thank my lucky stars, I did not marry someone like that. And now, how small talk opens up deeper connections. I used to dread my kids' soccer games, standing on the sidelines with parents I barely knew, fumbling through chit-chat about how nice the coaches are, how nice so-and-so is for bringing oranges, how nice it is that the sun came out. No matter how nice the day was, I wish my best friend was with me on the sideline. Unlike these relative strangers, she'd understand why I just jokingly called the latest play an Obama shambles, a delightful British term for a series of blunders and miscalculations. Instead of returning a black stare, she'd gossip about other Omni shambles that would make me gasp. These days, it can feel harder than ever to connect with people beyond our inner circle. We're worried we might hurt someone. We're worried we might be hurt. We don't want to intrude. In the event we're forced to interact with others, we avoid the prospect of harm by keeping things safe and dull. We discuss the weather, the snacks, the action at hand. As a parent compelled to prattle with other parents, this all sounds dire. But as a neuroscientist, I've come to see how small talk can be useful, not only for passing the time harmlessly, but also for forging the common ground necessary for more interesting and engaging interactions. We know that people sometimes mirror the tone and body language of the person they are talking to. In the lab, we see this mirroring in the brain too. Scans show that when people have similar views, their brains activate in similar ways. This synchrony, as we call it, can be helpful in creating a shared understanding. But does it lead to better conversations? To test this question, my collaborators and I gave pairs of strangers a game called Fast Friends, which involved taking turns asking and answering questions about themselves. The questions start with icebreakers: whom would you most like to have dinner with? And slowly become more personal. If you were to die this evening, what would you most regret not having said to someone? We found that the game encouraged the brains of strangers to synchronize. This year, when we published last year in the journal Nature Communication, makes intuitive sense. As people learn more about each other, they build a common language and common knowledge. This can be seen in the brain. When we studied friends playing the game, however, we saw something slightly different. They already had that baseline understanding, so their brains started to mirror one another faster than the trials with strangers. But they didn't stay synchronized. Instead, after the initial alignment, their brains diverged as they began exploring new topics and ideas. When the game was over, they reported high levels of enjoyment. In some cases, conversations between strangers resembled the conversations between friends. After establishing synchrony with the early questions, they ventured into more varied topics during which their brains diverged. When we asked how they felt afterwards, those participants also reported especially high levels of enjoyment. Finding common ground is clearly valuable, but it's best to see small talk as a launching pad for something else. The participants who enjoyed the Fast Friends game the most used the comfort forged by the icebreaker question to dive deeper and cover a wider range of topics. Instead of resenting small talk, I now see it as a gateway to a more meaningful connection. After some soothing chit-chat, I now feel more confident about taking risks and asking questions that I might have once worried were too far afield. I've since learned that fellow soccer parents might have been architects or traveling musicians. They didn't have kids. That quite a few fellow scientists have started reading romance novels, and that one colleague adores Secrets. It'll always feel tricky to steer a conversation beyond the weather, but the best way to cultivate more profound exchanges is to start small. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I'll be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.